I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, the push for peace. Hamas has accepted a draft proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza. How Israel is responding. Support.
USA!
And scrutiny.
Mr. Hegg said, I do not believe that you are qualified to meet the overwhelming demands of this job.
Defense Secretary nominee Pete Hegseth, a self-proclaimed change agent, is beginning his contentious confirmation hearings. We're on Capitol Hill. It's not a mystery. Hear from the Franciscan friar behind one of the most popular podcasts in the world. Plus, a brush with greatness. A new exhibit in Rome featuring a painting from America that is a favorite of the Holy Father. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network. This is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for joining us. Our top story tonight, after weeks of meetings, statements, and posturing, the Senate Armed Services Committee finally got to hear directly from Pete Hegseth, President-elect Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense. The former Fox TV host is the first of Trump's cabinet nominations to face a confirmation hearing. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. Pete Hegseth walked into the hearing room amid applause and chants of, quote, keep us safe. But the love was short-lived, at least among Democratic senators on the Armed Services Committee. They immediately hammered Hegseth over allegations of sexual assault, public drunkenness, and financial mismanagement. Hegseth began the hearing saying that he wants to bring back the war-fighting effort, the lethality in the U.S. military.
I'm going to work with President Trump and this committee to one, restore the warrior ethos to the Pentagon and throughout our fighting force. In doing so, we will reestablish trust in our military, addressing the recruiting crisis, the retention crisis, and readiness crisis in our ranks.
Members of the
Several times, Capitol Police were forced to remove protesters.
Shame on all of you! We need money!
Democrats were quick to bring up Hegseth's past.
The totality of your own writings and alleged conduct would disqualify any service member from holding any leadership position in the military, much less being confirmed as the Secretary of Defense.
A past that included criminal complaints and cash settlements to women. Hegseth claims that they were part of a smear campaign.
I sit here before you in open book, as everyone who's watched this process.
With multiple non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements tying the hands of many people who would like to comment to us.
I'm not a perfect person, but redemption is real. And God forged me in ways that I know I'm prepared for.
Hegseth was also asked about women serving in the military.
Will you support women continuing to have the opportunity to serve in combat roles?
Yes, women will have access to ground combat roles, combat rows, given the standards remain high, and we'll have a review to ensure the standards have not been eroded.
Hawaii Democrat Mazie Hirono asked if he would continue the travel reimbursement policy in the military for abortions.
Senator, I've always been personally pro-life. I know President Trump has as well, and we will review all policies, but our standard is whatever the president wants on this particular issue. With my advice, I will take a look at
it. If the president tells you that this policy will not be maintained, you will not enable our service members to seek reproductive care.
Two other points from the hearing. Hegseth says those service members who were let go for not accepting the COVID vaccine will be reinstated with back pay. He also testified that he agrees with the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that prevented gay service members from openly serving in the armed services. Now, the Armed Services Committee will take a vote Monday afternoon, just hours after President Trump is elected and officially sworn in, that is. It will then move to a full Senate vote later. Next week at the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Eric. Also on the Hill, the House narrowly passed a measure that could bring big changes to federally funded schools. The bill would amend Title IX, restricting biological males from playing on women and girls' sports teams. If a school violates the rule, it could lose federal funding. The bill now heads to the Senate. While U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that he believes a ceasefire in the Middle East will happen, officials say Hamas has accepted a draft agreement to release dozens of hostages in exchange for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The big question, though, is will it really happen, or is it just another failed attempt? White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, in a speech today, Secretary Blinken said, "It's right on the brink. It's closer than it's ever been before." And Hamas said in a statement that negotiations had reached their final stage.
In Gaza, people searching the rubble of a building destroyed in an Israeli strike. And as the war between Israel and Hamas continues for over 15 months now, in Washington, D.C., at the Atlantic Council, Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussing the Middle East, but multiple times interrupted by protesters who shouted that he was complicit in what they alleged were Israeli war crimes.
We strengthened America's robust sanctions regime on Iran and delivered on President Biden's commitment.
Regarding ongoing efforts to stop the fighting and reach a ceasefire.
But over the past several weeks, our intensive efforts have brought us to the brink of full and final agreement.
A final proposal, Blinken said, has been put forward.
The ball is now in Hamas's court. If Hamas accepts, the deal is ready to be concluded and implemented. I believe we will get a ceasefire.
If agreed to, fighting in Gaza would stop for 42 days. Dozens of hostages and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners would be freed. Israeli troops would pull back, and stepped-up aid would flow in. Today, an Israeli government spokesperson said in stage one of the agreement,
"It will be humanitarian. Women, children, those suffering illness, older people."
President Joe Biden said just yesterday they are working urgently to close the deal.
Palestinian people deserve peace and the right to determine their own futures. Israel deserves peace and real security. And the hostages and their families deserve to be reunited.
And in Jerusalem, family members of hostages held in captivity emphasizing they don't want more hostages left behind.
We are demanding from Prime Minister Netanyahu, from Qatar, from President-elect Trump, to agree upon all the stages of negotiation and get all the hostages back.
Also, as for that proposed ceasefire deal, it's a three-phase plan. It would need the approval of the Israeli cabinet. Meanwhile, overnight, it's reported that 18 people were killed in Israeli strikes in the Gaza Strip, including women and children. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
And as Owen mentioned, families of the hostages are watching these deals very closely, including the family of Yitia Hen, an Israeli-American citizen killed in the attacks on October 7th. His body was then taken into Gaza. And joining us now is his father, Ruby Hen. His son was one of the seven hostages held in Gaza. Ruby, thank you so much for joining us. We are so sorry for your loss, and our prayers are with you and your family. I know you have been and you continue to be a huge advocate for all the hostages. And you've said that any deal that does not include all Americans in phase one will be Biden's failure. Tell us why you say that.
Well, first, thanks for having me. It is 466 days since I last talked to my son. First, I'd like to say thank you to Mr. Brett McGurk that has basically moved to Doha in Qatar to bring this negotiation to where it is at the moment, as well as to Mr. Steve Witkoff, the incoming special president envoy to the Middle East that has been critical in the fact that he also has been traveling in the Middle East to give the support of the incoming administration to this agreement that is being put together. But it is a bit bittersweet. On one hand, we see progress, and there's a phase that sees movement towards getting some hostages out. The agreement itself has a lot of loopholes, and the families, are a bit concerned that this agreement does not go till the end, that we'll get all of the hostages out. And as a U.S. citizen, as a U.S. taxpayer, you know, I had hoped to believe that the United States leading this negotiation, it would find a way to bring all of its seven citizens out in this first phase. And unfortunately, my son, as a U.S. citizen, is not part of this first phase.
Yeah, and I know that you recently went to Doha. Tell us about that meeting over there.
Yeah, I felt it was important that the negotiators be able to look me in the eye family member and be able to get what all requests are, and not just getting it from the representatives of the United States or the Israeli negotiators as well. And as such, we decided to go to Doha and met the Qatari representatives from the Prime Minister office, from the Ministry of State, National Security Advisor, and basically told them that we, the families, you know, we want to see an agreement that has a framework, not for the first 10 hostages coming out, but understanding how the last hostages comes out. And anything less than that is insufficient in the family's viewpoint. And please.
Ruby, we have about a minute or so left. Quickly, I know that you and your wife are planning to come here into Washington, D.C. next week for President-elect Trump's inauguration. Are you optimistic about his administration's ability to get all the hostages back?
Yeah, so we've already had meetings with Mr. Mike Waltz, and we've created contact with additional State Department and State Department officials. And, you know, I have this vision that when coming to the inauguration, that indeed we will be able to hear from President Trump that invited us, that he would be able to say to me, Mr. Chen, just like President Reagan many, many years ago in his inauguration was able to say, I brought out all of the U.S. hostages out on my first day in office. What a fabulous piece of news that would be if you would be able to say the same thing to us and say, we got all the kids back home. And that's what I'm praying for and hoping that we have that moment, if not in the inauguration, at least soon afterwards.
Yeah, and we are praying for that as well. Ruby, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a major change is coming to U.S.-Cuba relations, but it may be short-lived. The Biden administration is lifting the designation of the island nation as a state sponsor of terrorism. It is part of a deal facilitated by the Catholic Church to free political prisoners on the island. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo imposed the designation in January of 2021, just before leaving office. And now the Biden administration says that an assessment has shown that there is no reason for the designation. However, the move is likely to be reversed when President-elect Trump takes office. In his final report, Special Counsel Jack Smith claims that there was enough evidence to convict President-elect Trump. The 137-page report on Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election, which culminated in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, released overnight. The Justice Department closed its investigation because of Trump's November win, which shields him from prosecution. Just after 2 a.m., Trump posted on Truth Social calling Smith deranged and said this showed how totally innocent he was. In a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, Smith wrote, claims that dismissal of his criminal cases signifies Mr. Trump's complete exoneration. That is false. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including the wind and fire, a warning forecast for the wildfires in Los Angeles, and how the Archdiocese is helping those in need. Plus, off the beaten path, learn why it may soon be difficult to find eggs in the grocery store. Officials fighting the deadly wildfires in Los Angeles say that firefighters are prepared for the strong winds that threaten even more neighborhoods. Amid the threat of hurricane-force winds, firefighters are being deployed around the city, including in areas where the flames have not yet reached. One leading fire official says that the worst predictions are for today and tomorrow.
The worst winds are predicted today for the late afternoon and into Wednesday. Please be assured that the Los Angeles County region is prepared.
Well, the wildfires have thus far claimed at least 24 lives, but even in the destruction, there is faith and hope. One pregnant Catholic mother of four who lost her home and all of her belongings says, quote, God does things for a reason, adding that she and her husband trust that the Lord will provide something even better than what was lost. And joining us now to tell us more about that mom from Altadena, Claudia De La Rosa, and how other Catholics in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles are relying on their faith to get them through this devastating time is Pablo Kay, editor-in-chief of Angeles News. Pablo, good to be with you today. I know that y'all recently talked to Claudia and her family, and that story is up on your website. For those maybe who haven't seen it yet, tell us a little bit more about her and her family and what they've been through and how their Catholic faith is really sustaining them during this time.
Yeah, it was really incredible to speak to her and then hear her story. Like many of those affected by these fires, I mean, they're just a normal family, four children expecting the fifth, very active in their parish. They belong to the neo-catechumenal way. This just caught them by total surprise. I mean, even with the winds here, we knew the winds, there were alerts, weather alerts and stuff, but I don't think anybody expected anything like this. And so they really had minutes to get out of their home, like so many others. And just to hear, they're not the only ones, to hear people who have lost everything. They see God at work. They see something about this is teaching them what's important in life, where life comes from, right? I think this all puts the question to us, you know, what is life? Is it health? Is it security? Is it money? Is it or is there something deeper? You know, speaking to a parishioner the other day from the parish that was destroyed in Pacific Palisades, a pretty affluent area of LA, and he said, you know, we're all a bit humbler now. Mm-hmm. And this guy lost everything, and you know, they were all confident that they'll rebuild their homes. Their parish, which was totally lost, Corpus Christi. It's really been edifying to talk to a lot of these people and hear their stories.
Yeah, and I know the Archdiocese is doing a lot to help folks. I mean, they need our prayers, but they also need physical things as well, clothes, food, shelter. Tell us how the Archdiocese is stepping in to help them.
Well, we're the biggest archdiocese in the country, so you can imagine there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of, I think, parishes and schools that are just taking the initiative to do what they can as soon as they can. And we've seen that in the last week. I think the first night or two, it was the parishes nearest the fires, ones that could remain open, would open some of their gyms and schools just as places really to hang out. To get some snacks, to take a hot shower. One principal took out board games and put on movies just for kids to have something to do while their parents waited to find out if their homes had been lost or not. And now we've seen it progress into really this huge humanitarian effort. So many parishes and schools have begun donation drives. I was at a school the other day where it was like a maze of clothes, supplies, diapers, toys, even all these donations, some used clothes, but also at this particular school in Santa Monica, they told me that there were piles of clothes donated by kind of high-end fashion stores and designers who wanted to offload some of their inventory or their samples. So you're seeing all kinds of creativity and generosity. It's amazing. And people who may not be Catholic or may not be practicing, but they know that the neighborhood parish is doing something.
Yeah, and we all have to step in and help out. Pablo, thank you so much for talking to us. Please be assured of our prayers and know that we're all going to be helping out and praying for you and continue to follow this story. Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you, Tracy.
All right, staying here in the United States, if you head to the grocery store anytime soon, you may have to scramble to find some eggs. The United States is currently experiencing an egg shortage due to the avian flu. The USDA says that in November and December, more than 17 million egg-laying hens died from the virus. The lack of eggs is leading to much higher prices. The average price of a dozen eggs at the end of December was, get this, $4.33. Wow. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, How I Met Our Mother. We hear from the Franciscan friar behind a popular podcast dedicated to the rosary. Depiction of the crucifixion of our Lord that is beloved by Pope Francis has left the United States for the first time, and it is headed to Rome to be a part of the Jubilee year 2025. EWTN Vatican journalist Magdalena Valinsky-Reedy has more.
It became known as the Kristallnacht, German for Night of Broken Glass. During the overnight hours of November the 9th and 10th, 1938, Nazi leaders launched brutal attacks on Jewish communities across Germany and occupied territories. They destroyed synagogues, homes and shops, leaving the streets covered in shattered glass. In response to the horrifying events of that night, Russian-French artist Marc Chagall painted one of his masterpieces, The White Crucifixion.
Chagall, expressing this tremendous grief, even though he's living in Paris, but he's expressing this tremendous grief for the Jewish communities all over Germany, he produces this extraordinary cry of sadness, of mourning in the work of White Crucifixion.
The crucified Jesus is in the center of the masterpiece, clothed in traditional Jewish garments amid scenes of persecution in Nazi Germany. He's a symbol of all Jews suffering at that time. From the pillaged village and fleeing villagers on the left side of the canvas to the synagogue and its Torah are going up in flames on the right, the violent images Chagall depicted came from actual events in the years leading up to the painting. The famous artwork is normally part of the permanent collection at the Art Institute of Chicago, but in honor of the 2025 Jubilee, it was sent to Rome for the first time ever. It is part of the fourth exhibition of the Jubilee Sculpture Season, entitled Chagall in Rome.
This, like the other exhibitions we have brought to Rome for this Jubilee, is meant to be a sign of hope and peace, a dialogue between peoples.
The painting combines traditional Christian iconography on the canvas with markers of Jesus' Jewish identity. It is a powerful symbol of religious unity, projecting a strong message in the defense of human dignity and dialogue between cultures. Chagall's masterpiece is one of Pope Francis's beloved works of art. It was no coincidence that the Pope visited the exhibition back in December, short after its opening.
Il Santo Padre sì, si è fermato qualche minuto.
The Holy Father stopped here for a few minutes, among the other visitors who were present. You can imagine the general astonishment. As he left, he reflected on the profound meanings contained in this work, so much suffering surrounding this symbol of peace, which is Christ. He marked on how it serves as a powerful symbol that encourages reflection, thought, and prayer simply by looking at it.
In Rome, Magdalena Volinskariedi, EWTN News Nightly.
In the world of podcasts, Joe Rogan usually reigns supreme, but at the start of the new year, another podcast topped the charts, one centered on the rosary. EWTN's Mark Irons reports.
You beat out Joe Rogan. How does that feel?
Yeah, I don't know yet. I'm still figuring it out.
What does that mean?
Exactly. I think it's a good, it's got to be a good sign.
Why do you think that is?
I think a number of reasons, but I do think it's not the popular narrative, but I do think people want God. Like, there are many people who want God and want a relationship with God and want to go deeper in the relationship with God. And it shows through, the success of Bible in the year, Catechism in the year, and again now here with Rosary in the year. The thing in common is just it's a way to guide people and help them in their journey. And so there's definitely an appetite for it.
Tell us about the podcast, Rosary in a Year podcast.
Yeah, so the Rosary in a Year, really, I think the best way to kind of understand it in sort of like a bite-sized way is, I think it's a school of prayer with the Rosary as the classroom and the textbook. Because it's all there in the Rosary. you know, all of the prayers, the mysteries, it brings us to the scripture, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, the Glory Be, who God is, you know, the incarnation, the resurrection, his passion, like it's all there, you know. And so the rosary, again, like the Lord has invited us and called us in John Paul II in his letter on the rosary, like we need Christians who are praying. And I think there's so much great formation and so many people who have a desire to pray, but they also sort of echo this sort of question or this request of these early apostles, like, teach us how to pray, you know? And so this is just a way to guide people and to help them go deeper in their own lives of prayer. And my hope is that essentially the rosary in the year leverages the genius of the rosary insofar as that it's a prayer that a six-year-old can pray. It's a prayer that the greatest of saints like John Paul II can pray, or Padre Pio. You know, it's the genius of it is that it can kind of be all of us where we're at and help us to kind of make the next best step in our spiritual life.
There might be many young people who say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. We see large numbers of people walking away from organized religion. Why should a young person practice their Catholic faith?
Yeah. You know, a lot of reasons. The one that comes to mind is this is the religion that God set up. This is where God like fully revealed himself. And this is where God like revealed the perfect path to come to know him, but also to come to union with him. And the heart, like there's so many downsides to spirituality, pursuing God without religion, like a vast majority of them. But one of them is certainly is like pretty quickly you become your own guide, your own shepherd, your own God. And you have to try and figure it out by yourself. And it's just not going to lead you where you're meant to go. And the beauty of Catholicism is like, God has just shown us the way. We don't have to figure it out. We just have to say yes and follow. And what we will find is like this perfect experience of God and his fatherhood and all of the fruits that come with that.
What is that first?
All right. And to see Mark's full interview with Father Mark Mary, you can find that on EWTN's YouTube page. So make sure you check that out. And thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night and God bless.